today's Taisho will be on case 37 in the Book of Serenity. Case 37 is entitled Guishan's Active Consciousness. Driving away the plowman's ox, pulling its nose around, taking away the hungry man's food, holding his throat tight. Is there anyone who can administer the poison? Case, Guishan asked Yangshan, if someone suddenly said all sentient beings just have active consciousness, boundless and unclear, with no fundamental to rely on, not only is their active consciousness boundless and unclear, they have no fundamental to rely on. Guishan said, good. Verse. One call and he turns his head. Do you know the self or not? Vaguely, like the moon through ivy, a crescent at that. The child of riches, as soon as he falls on the boundless road of destitution, has such sorrow. So today is the first day of our beautiful sesshin, our winter sesshin. Normally, winter sesshins take place in December. Around the full moon of December. But the academic calendar makes that difficult to do. That's like exam week or something. So we have our winter sesshin in January. And it's quite wonderful. Everything went so beautifully last night, just so beautifully. Everybody arrived, they made it here safely before the big snowfall. And then last night, a prodigious amount of snow fell. And this morning, it's just beautiful out there, absolutely beautiful. We've been doing sesshin here for many years, and occasionally we have had sesshins where there's been no snow. In fact, a few years ago, there was a sesshin where it was in the high 60s. People were outside in their t-shirts, sunning themselves. But this is a classic winter sesshin, and it's really quite wonderful that we could all get here before the snow fell, and now we're sort of snowed in. And I think that's just great, really beautiful. Being here together, doing zazen with the snow. Snow is really magical because it puts an end to so many things that are maybe not that important. You know, people running to and fro, busy, caught up in 10,000 things. You know, basically, if you need some grapes, you're sitting in your house and you think, gee, I already have some grapes. So you jump in the car and you drive over to the shop right and you get some grapes and you drive back. And now I've got the grapes, you know. And this is modern life, but, you know, everybody's running around in their cars, busy, and suddenly the snow falls. And people think, well, maybe I don't need those grapes. You know, it's a lot of hassle to get out there, and I have to undig my car, I have to clear the driveway, and maybe I'll just sit, you know, just be quiet, sit at home. And, you know, after a big storm, when you get up and you listen, you hear no cars, or the muffled sound of cars, because everybody everybody's decided to get off the road. So it's really like a transformation. You get up one day and it's very, very busy, and you can hear cars and this and that. And then the next day you wake up and it's really still and peaceful. And it's really wonderful. That kind of stillness and peace is not normally valued in our society. You know, if you go into a Japanese garden, you often see spaces that are meant to be places where your mind can become calm and focused. You might turn a corner and look at a pond with irises in it, and you think, oh, I'm so at peace right this moment. And the whole structure of the garden is designed to put your mind at rest. I was reading recently that if they construct a Japanese garden in a hospital for Alzheimer's patients, it immediately has a powerful calming impact. And they said that people who have Alzheimer's can be very distracted, very distressed, agitated. And for various reasons, they're frightened because their mental world is slipping away and they are anxious. But if they are taken to a Japanese garden, that vocabulary of the garden calms them and puts their mind at ease. And they begin, this is really, I think, quite remarkable. When I was in California recently, I had a chance to go out to the Chinese garden at the Huntington. And it's a Suzhou-style Chinese garden. It's really beautiful, and I was sick actually there too, so I didn't really have the chance to explore it too much. But quite beautiful, and my mind was at rest. So some cultures have understood the importance of silence and calm and peace. And this is like very important. Zen is not really about clinging to silence and calm and peace. You can be in deep samadhi in the middle of a busy street. But in your deep samadhi, it's silent and it's calm. And so, when snow falls, it's like samadhi has descended on the world. A little bit of samadhi mind has fallen, and now everybody is a little bit in samadhi. And that's cool, I think. It's very nice. Snow is a symbol enlightened mind in Chinese Buddhism. Frost is a symbol of enlightened mind. The snow is blank, right? It's blank. And it has no features. But it has this effect of creating calm. Empty. Snow is empty, calm. It's blank. And so when you have snow, it's like a Buddha mind falls out of the sky. Everybody gets up, and for a little while, they're in awe of this state of being that the snow shows us. We Zen people know what this is like. You know, sitting on the cushion is like having a mind of snow. You know, it's like having a blank, it could be dark or bright mind with no features, calm, stable, beautiful. And it's quite wonderful when this is outside and inside at the same time. So it's really magical to sit on a snowy day like this. And the snow is a great teacher of Zen, believe it or not. Last week, the week before last, we had a huge snow. And I have a snow shovel. And I got up and I spent the day shoveling snow. And I love to shovel snow. It's very relaxing. You know, you get outside and it's quiet and it's calm. And I could use a little bit of upper body exercise. You know. So shoveling snow is tiring. At the end of a day of shoveling snow, you're usually pretty tired. But it's good exercise. And I felt so harmonious. Down the street, there's a wonderful man whose name is Gary. And he's really a very kind man, and he has a giant snowblower. You know? And he was nice enough to go down the street we live on, the whole street, with his snowblower and blow, and it really it just chews the snow up and shoots it out of a big chute. And he went down the whole street and cleaned off the sidewalk for the whole street. He did both sides of the street. And he is a nice man. And he said, "Would you like me to do your driveway?" And I said, "No, please don't. Because I like shoveling the snow." And he didn't think that was strange. He understood. But I have to say, something is lost when we take this machine and we just blow all the snow away. I'm not criticizing you if you own a snowblower. You know, I'm not saying you have to do it my way. But I like that experience of getting close to the snow. You know, you're just shoveling with your shovel, and you can feel the weight of the snow. And you're out in the cold, and you feel cold. It's really lovely. Anyway, snow. Great teacher. It puts everybody at rest, at ease. One of the greatest things about snow, if you're a kid, is of course that you don't have to go to school. Right? I can remember praying at night, praying for snow. My mother would say, "Don't you think you should do your homework?" And I'd go, "No, no, it's going to snow." She'd say, "I think you should do your homework." And I might not really do it. And then I would lie there and think, "Oh my God, what if it doesn't snow?" Right? But snow is so beautiful because you don't have to go to school. I have been, as you know, a little sick. I have the flu. I got here late yesterday because I went to the doctor. And I was hoping he would give me some antibiotics. My doctor is a really good doctor, and you would have to really be dying before he would give you antibiotics. You know, so I went in and I had him. He examined me, and all my friends have gotten antibiotics. In fact, I was at a meeting yesterday morning, and I couldn't stop coughing. And my friend said, "Oh, you obviously have a respiratory infection. You need to get a CPAC." He said, "Just go to your doctor, and he'll give you a CPAC." I thought, "Oh, you don't know my doctor." So I went to my doctor and I told him, "Oh, I've had this thing for more than a week." And he said, "Yeah, it's the flu." And then he said, "I'll give you Tamiflu for it." And I didn't have the courage to ask him for antibiotics because I knew he would say no. And he would be right, you know. So anyway, I took the Tamiflu last night and it seems to be helping. I was coughing so much this morning that I moved into the dining room. And it reminded me of when I was a kid and I would get sick. I don't know about you, but being sick when you're a kid is not such a bad experience. Maybe you have a different memory of it, but for me, being sick was really a great experience. It was like snow. Yeah. Because again, you don't have to go to school. And I would remember my mother, you know, saying, "Oh, you do look bad." And I, "Oh, yes. I'm really sick." And I'd roll my eyes. And she'd go, "We better take your temperature." And she took my temperature and I had a fever. And I felt sick, you know, I wasn't faking it. And she said, "Oh, you're really sick. You can't go to school today." It's like, oh. And then, you know, I would lie in bed, especially if I were sick, you know, you don't feel very strong. And lie in bed, and my mother would bring me things. She'd bring me ice, crushed ice, if I had a fever. She used to make this thing, which is really terrible for you. She'd make something out of butter and some spices and some sugar. And she'd say, "This will help your throat." I doubt it did. It was very tasty. And everybody was nice to me when I was sick. The other good thing about being sick was the freedom, right? Just real freedom. I used to read when I was sick. I would just spend the day reading. And it was so nice, you know, because there's no school bus to catch. There's no classes. It would just be peace and quiet, being present in the moment and enjoying your life. And for some reason, being sick sort of calms the mind, you know. I remember that Soyan Shaku had a poem about being sick, and he said, "Sickness is my attendant monk." In other words, sickness is like a monk who takes care of me. Now I have to confess that I took the Tamiflu, and I took, also Richard gave me medicine, a homeopathic medicine that I think really is helping. And I took that last night. And also Jaru made kind of a syrup, cough, like Chinese cough syrup. And it's quite tasty and it's full of herbs that coat your throat. So everybody's given me all these cool little things, you know. And I feel very pampered, you know. And I feel a little weak, but I feel very calm and very happy, even though I'm sick, you know. And I remember being a kid like that and feeling very taken care of. And like, there's nowhere to go today. There's nothing to do. I'm just going to be here and enjoy myself. And I think you could say that when you're sick, you have like an altered state of consciousness. You know? So you're not thinking in your usual way because you have a little fever. Your response time is different and so on. Maybe you're less self-centered when you're sick. Maybe body and mind are less separate. But it's like having the snowfall, you know. There's something about being sick which is a little bit like sesshin. And there's something about the snow which is a little bit like sesshin. You know, everything is going to stop for 5 days. We have all kinds of projects. We have all kinds of objectives and deadlines and goals in our lives. And there's nothing wrong with that. You can't be sick forever. At some day point, you have to get better and go back to school. But it's a real treat to be sick and to sit at home and read all day. Have people bring you things that are tasty to eat. Sesshin is like a break, a time out, so that you can recover. This is like a karma hospital, you know. So normally we're going through the day and we become very, very, very driven by our intentionality, you know, by our purposes. And that way of life is especially true now in the modern world. You know, I think that in ancient times, people had much less control over their lives. So, you know, if you were a farmer, if you were a farmer, your kids were going to be farmers, pretty much. And, you know, you just grew up being a farmer. And now you get to create your own life. So you can choose to be a doctor or a pharmacist or an artist or a scientist. And life becomes like a project, right? It becomes a project. And you want to have a good outcome. So now life is not just given to you. It's something you have to make. And you can make it skillfully or unskillfully. And if you are unskillful, that can cause you a lot of distress. And so, you know, we go through life constantly pursuing these goals, and more or less successfully. And we get to be very locked into one kind of intelligence, I think, which is this goal-oriented intelligence. So, you know, I wrote a grant with my friend Veena Kumar, and we're going to try to set up a school, a Rutgers English Institute in India. And I wrote this grant with Veena about 2 months ago, and we submitted it to the dean, and we asked for about $150,000 in seed money, which is peanuts, right, in the world of business. But we met with the business manager, and he said, this looks very good, but, you know, we'll have to go back and assess your proposal because we have 15 proposals. So I got back from Los Angeles, and Veena came to see me. She seemed sad, and I said, Veena, what's wrong? She said, our proposal didn't get accepted. And I said, well, what happened? And she said, well, there were 15 proposals. 11 were rejected completely. 2 were accepted, and 2 are on hold. And ours is one of the ones that's on hold. And I said, well, that's great. At least we didn't get rejected. But she wanted to get it accepted right away. But what they asked for was very reasonable. They asked for more details about our plan. You know, Veena probably worried about this all week before I came back. It would have been nice to have the dean's office say, we love your proposal. You've got it. But instead, they gave us a kind of a mixed message. We like it, but we're not sure. And it caused Veena some distress. So this is very typical of modern life, right? We have a goal, we're pursuing it. Usually, things don't turn out the way we plan. I think that's often the case. So there's always a certain kind of like a tension or a stress created by the way in which our intentions are not working out, you know. Veena, when she talked to me, I finally got her to see that this was really a great thing, that we're probably going to get the money. They just said they want more information. And when she left the meeting, I think she was a little happier. But it's still the same mentality, right? It's goal-oriented mentality, and there's nothing wrong with that. But there is another way to live, which is not goal-oriented. And when we sit on the cushion, we are entering this other kind of consciousness. You know, every moment is, in that consciousness, every moment is equal to every other moment. And every moment is like opening up of our true nature. So when you sit on the cushion and you are practicing zazen and sashin, it's true you might want to be working on your koan. You might be trying to answer your koan. But in a deeper sense, what we're really trying to do is be totally present with the moment as it is right now. In that moment, there usually is an answer to our koan. But the goal of Zen meditation is to be present 100% with whatever is happening now. And there's no preference. So you're not saying this moment is better than that moment. You're saying, I accept this moment, and I accept this moment, and I accept this moment, and I accept this moment. This is the goal of Zen. Of course, it's not so easy to accept the moment, right? Because we have expectations, or we have complicated karma. So my friend Vina really had a different scenario in her mind. She worked very hard on this proposal, and she was hoping they would just give her the green light. But they didn't do that, and it caused her a lot of distress. Now that can happen at sashin too. You know, if you're watching your breath, watch your breath. If you're working on mu, you're working on mu. But most people bring to the cushion the kind of purpose-driven mentality that they practice in their daily lives. So you might imagine that when you come to sashin, you're going to have a great awakening experience, or you're going to solve your koan, or something else. No. But, you know, when you begin to do zazen, you begin to shift into this other mentality, this other mindset. And it's not by any means dreamy or passive or foggy or something like that. It's very alive. Every moment, all kinds of things are happening. Yeah, in a very dynamic and exciting way. And normally the mind is unable to participate in that spontaneity, that spontaneous unfolding, because we are anxious about the outcome, or we are fearful. You know, things in our life may have made us fearful. I have a friend of mine who has what you could call a phobia. He can't drive over a bridge. I'm not kidding. He used to go to Chincoteague in Maryland every year with his family, and there's a huge bridge. It's much larger than the bridge down by Perth Amboy. You know, if you get on the Garden State, you have to go over that big bridge over by Perth Amboy, and it goes up in the air, and then it goes down. But there's one on the way down to the Chesapeake area. It's really huge, and you go up, 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 until you're up in the clouds. And my friend said he was driving that, and all of a sudden he began to shake uncontrollably. And he was absolutely unable. He pulled the car over, and he asked his wife to drive. And this is a phobia, right? This is his father tried to commit suicide. And he witnessed his father in a condition. His father didn't succeed in killing himself, but he came in upon his father after his father tried to kill himself, and he called the hospital and so on and so on. So, you know, possibly that experience created this phobia, you know, being up high in the air with no grounding. Sort of floating is terrifying to my friend. there must be some connection there. That we all have maybe phobias, you know, or things that make us nervous or unhappy. And so when we sit down on the cushion, we would like to be totally in the moment, from moment to moment, as this beautiful world unfolds. But sometimes we have strong fears created by our life experience. And sometimes we have expectations that are also created by our fears, generally. And so there's a tension between what we want to have happen and what's happening. And so sometimes Zazen is a matter of working through some of those obstacles. Years ago, there was a young man who was doing sesshin here, and he came into the Dokusan room to see me individually, and he was very snide, or very somewhat insulting. You know, he was a little bit negative, and he was really sort of like pissed off at me. And he, you know, was like, "Well, how is your sit?" And he was like, "Well, what do you, how do you think it should be? You know, my legs are killing me." And I said, "Well, I'm sorry to hear that." You know, and it was like, "Yeah, well, how come you make the sit so long?" And things like that. That happens. So you know, and I just tried to be pleasant. You know, I said, "Well, it's my job. You know, they're all supposed to, they're not that long." So anyway, you know, around day five of the sesshin, this guy, it was clear that this guy had come from a very abusive home. And that sort of, he hadn't allowed himself to think about that. And he came into the Dokusan room, and he was crying. And he said, I said, "Why are you crying?" And he said, "Because I was mean to my dog. I was mean to my dog." And he said, "My dog is so full of love. Why am I mean to my dog?" And I said, "This is really important, you know. This is really a wonderful moment because some of these obstacles are being worked through." And the next time he came in, he said, "I'm going to call my brother. Tell him that I love him," you know. So, you know, that sometimes we have these obstacles, you know, that we have to work through at sesshin. And often they're not even things we allow ourselves to see. And that happens too. But little by little, if you just keep coming back to the moment, you know, it might seem a little boring at first. It's just watching your breath, watching your breath, watching your breath, watching your breath. You think this is for idiots, right? But at some point, if you shift into a deeper consciousness, you begin to notice that your breath is very alive. It's very lively. And that when you watch your breath, you feel very lively. And it's actually not boring at all. And same thing with moo. You know, you're just saying moo, 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 moo. At some point, you begin to feel this great energy arising. And when you get off the cushion, it may not be on day two, but eventually, when you get off the cushion, you have this tremendous energy. So this way of life, of not having goals and being fully present in the moment, is the Zen way of life. And it's not a matter of being sleepy or tranquilized or anything like that. It's really about being fully present, one with what is happening in this moment, so that the unfolding of the world is like the unfolding of your own life. And that's quite exciting. Normally, the unfolding of our life is like a challenging game. It's like playing chess. We're trying to produce a certain outcome. And so life has the character of being like a game playing with the universe. And there's a winner and there's a loser. And so, you know, you'll hear people say, I just can't win. You know, I just can't win. I can't get a break from life. And indeed, people sometimes have really difficult experiences, you know. But, you know, there's another way to experience the world, which is the Zen way. And it's not divided from life. It's not playing adversarial. It's not an adversarial relationship with life. It's like you become the universe on the cushion. And it's not a delusion. I mean, we know in a certain way that that life is one big life. You know, life is one big life. People in ancient times, this was so obvious, right? If you look at the world, the natural world, you see individual creatures come and go, right? They come and go. There used to be a squirrel outside of our house. My wife would feed the squirrel walnuts. And there was this one squirrel that my wife really loved. And he was a broken down old squirrel. One of his ears, you know, he was pathetic. One of his ears was floppy down. And my wife, being a very compassionate person, would give him a nut, you know, and he would be so happy. And after a while, he would be right there, you know. If you came out on the porch, he'd be there. And I think he had arthritis or something. You know, he was this old beaten up squirrel. And my wife would give him a peanut, and he'd be so happy, you know. And not a peanut, a walnut, and it would be delicious. I'm sure. I like walnuts myself. This last year he was gone. You know, so whatever, I can't remember his name. Barbara gave him a name, but he's gone. That's sad, but we know it's going to happen, right? You know, it's the way of the world, right? I mean, squirrels come and go, and humans come and go. 50 years from now, you know, I'll be gone. Some of you will still be around, you know, and eventually, nobody will even know my name. Now this could be like the source of incredible agony, but it's the way of the world, right? We're part of one way to respond to that is to be very unhappy and to say, I'm going to make sure that people remember me. I'm going to build a bridge, or I'm going to be. I promise you that in 100 years. Only scholars will know who Bill Gates was, you know? Some you say, oh no, they'll all know Bill Gates. It's not true. You know, basically, people won't remember him. So there's a way of living which is based upon this particular squirrel, you know? And that's part of how we have to live. But there's another way of life which is bigger. And you see the unfolding of everything. Unfolding of everything. You feel part of something bigger than yourself, right? And this was very highly valued in ancient times. When people lived closer to nature, they understood that squirrels come and go, humans come and go. But there's something that always remains, and it's this oneness, this big life. And I think we feel real joy when we encounter that big life. I like to hike. This summer, I had the chance to hike the Teton Crest Trail in Wyoming with my old friend Larry Sullivan. It's about 50 miles, and it was brutal. You know, really, yeah. I mean, I was a bit out of shape. And at the end of the first couple of days, I could barely move. You know. You get up there in those mountains, which are so majestic, and it puts the human life in perspective. You know, we're just these little creatures walking on the surface of this majestic mountain range. And, being able to participate in the existence of this beautiful Teton Crest Trail, just being here, being part of it all, it makes your heart just fly up, right? You know, being, when you feel that kind of connection, you feel that kind of, the boundary between yourself and the world disappear, and everywhere you turn, you know, we were hiking through these alpine mountains full of flowers, and there was snow, water running off from the snow through the alpine meadow. And I didn't think, oh, I'm Kurt. You know, I was just, my head was just so full of the beauty of this whole scene, you know. And I felt so at ease, you know, so deeply at ease. And that's very much like Zen, feeling deeply at ease with the world and being a part of something bigger. That's very much what Zen is about. So today is the first day of our beautiful winter sesshin. And at some point, it may not be today, it may not be tomorrow, it might be day three, so please stick around. But at some point, you're going to feel this transition happen, you know, where, you know, we come to sesshin with a lot of anxieties, disappointments, fears, and so on and so on. And we sit for a day, and we begin to let them go. And then, you know, around tomorrow, you'll have let them go, but you'll be getting very tired. And you'll be thinking, maybe, why did I come here? This is really a challenge. But usually what happens around day three is that there's like this shift in your consciousness. And it's suddenly like going up to the top of the Tetons. You know, you suddenly feel, I'm part of something so much bigger than myself. And I feel so alive. And I'm not troubled at all knowing that I'm here just for a little while. And that is really a wonderful state of mind. So anyway, we're here. We have this chance to experience life in a different way, life as this great connectedness. Thich Nhat Hanh says interbeing. And so we have a chance to experience interbeing. It's very much, it's quite wonderful. So thank you for your excellent efforts this morning. Everybody sat beautifully. And you're just keep going. Keep watching your breath. If you feel pain, watch the breath. You know, if you feel pain in your legs, focus on your breath. Follow the breath out. And when you watch the breath going out, 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 the pain in your legs will eventually diminish. And if you just keep watching the breath, it will take you eventually to a place where there is no pain, or very little pain. So keep focusing on the breath. And when you get to that place, you're very close to this awareness that's connected to everything. You're almost there. You just keep going. And this would not be... Oh, yeah, what about the koan? I forgot. The good news is this. You know, the bad news is that we get very far from Buddha mind. We get caught up in winning and losing, in right and wrong, etc. And it causes a lot of anguish and distress. And we also can have phobias and other kinds of fears that were created by events in our life that make it hard to be present in the moment. But consciousness itself is fundamentally enlightened. And that's very important. You know, that consciousness itself, at the core of our own consciousness, there's this spacious, calm, unshakable place. And fundamentally, Buddha nature is consciousness. And so all we have to do is sit quietly and return to our original state. And it will happen. It has to happen. So, you know, you can't miss. So let's just...